This is the JN Podcast in association with Janie, the mental health charity for the community. I'm Phil Dave, and coming up on this show, TV's Robert Rinder, that's Judge Rinder to you and me, will tell us why he's lent his support to the Sue Harris Trust, which is campaigning to recruit potential stem cell donors in the community. Rabbi David Meyer of Pages, the Partnership for Jewish Schools, will chat about what measures are being taken for pupils to return to education. Our COVID hero this week will be the wonderful Raymond Simonson, Chief Executive of JW3. He'll be chatting about how the community centre has been turned into more of a food hub. More on that later on. I'll also be speaking to Pavel Savishsky, who will be telling me about a fascinating discovery that's been made during a conservation project at Auschwitz. And we have a nice shiny new feature involving comedian Ashley Blaker. So believe me, you don't want to miss that. But before all of that, welcome along to this episode of the JN Podcast, and let's kick things off as we usually do each week with a look at your copy of the Jewish News. Joining me to go through it is editor Richard Ferrer and supplements editor Bridget Grant. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Phil.
Hi.
Now, let's start off with the front page, shall we? The headline reads, "Cancer time bomb caused by pandemic. 70% fall in newly diagnosed patients seeking support due to coronavirus." I assume this is the warning that's come from High Cancer Care.
Yeah, our all-consuming focus, Phil, on fighting this pandemic has overshadowed other life and death priorities. And High Cancer Care this week have come out with some stark figures to actually put into focus quite how pressing the issue has become since the lockdown began. They've seen a 70% drop in number of patients making first-time calls. So just to give you absolute hard facts here, since the 12th of March, they've had 17 first calls compared with 55 over the same period last year. Because, I mean, people aren't going to their GPs, are they? People are staying away from surgeries, from chemists, from A&Es. I mean, people are simply doing as little as possible to put themselves at risk, especially people who are in the high risk categories, which of course cancer patients and others are. So you can understand the reticence, but the message from High this week is to, if you are hesitant, seek medical help sooner rather than later.
And I have to say, Bridget, as well, I think that this is, people are probably going to be forgiven for thinking that nothing else exists at the moment. We're just hearing so much about COVID-19 that it would be very easy for one to neglect one's health and to not focus on other conditions that may arise as a result of it.
Well, I think certainly in terms of the charities, which High is, this whole thing about them being put on a back burner, there is no back burner for charity for these kind of conditions. I mean, cancer is a reality that will still be there when they find a vaccine for COVID. It will be there. And the point is that we now need to take a step back and look at all the charities and the work that they're doing, because long after they've resolved this issue, there will still be the issue of cancer, which there is no cure for. And those people need to be helped now. So I think that we need to now stop doing the pleas for charities that are just raising money for COVID and look at our existing charities and the support they need.
Absolutely. Now, one of the other things that is playing on people's minds at the moment is the reopening of schools from next week. We'll find out more about that with Rabbi David Meyer later on in the program. He, of course, is the executive director of Pages. But on page 5 of the Jewish News this week, 20 Jewish schools reassure parents.
My two little cherubs are going back to reception in year one next week in their small bubbles, or what do they call them, hives or huddles, whatever each school is referring to them. So we had 20 Jewish schools who've signed a letter this week reassuring mums and dads like me that there are procedures going to be in place. God, I mean, I don't know if you remember, Bridget, when your teenager was a 4 and 5 and 6 year old, but I mean, little bundles of germs, aren't they? They don't know about social distancing. They'd sooner lick their desk and kiss you than stay 2 meters away. So obviously, I mean, seriously speaking, there are a lot of health and hygiene issues here, and routines need to be reintroduced, and children need to reacclimatize, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're asking an awful lot of, I mean, I've read the piece, and I've read Fran's piece in the paper about, you know, what the rules are around this. And quite frankly, in my view, they're ludicrous. I mean, you will not get little children to social distance. It's also particularly hard for, and a lot of teachers in Jewish schools have children of various ages. So two of them go back, one of them's at home. How they orchestrate all of that, I think, is incredibly difficult. The idea that you're going to put them in groups and that at playtime they'll be in separate areas. I mean, this is unachievable in reality, and very, very difficult for those parents who don't fall into that we're going back to school category.
I understand your reticence, Bridget. There is an absolute need and a desire. I mean, you speak to someone like the head of Sinai, Juliet Lipshaw, who we spoke to for the piece. Her teachers have a sense of joy and excitement about the kids coming back and about the kids being shown how they can reacclimatise, how they can be together with their friends again, and how they can be made to feel secure and normal again. I mean, they have to go back at some point, and I think this slow move towards reacclimatization, they're only going back for a day or two a week before the summer, is absolutely the right thing at the right time.
And one thing we have to hope as well is that, based on the knowledge that we have, that supposedly those who are younger have less of a risk as far as the virus is concerned, it seems like the logical first step to reintroduce normality to that age group, based on that the risk for them is lower, and use it maybe as a barometer to the rest of society to try and slowly but surely get back to a sense of normality. Of course, there is more information given on this very story as well on page 27, where the headline is "The New School Rules." And of course, that's where it goes into more detail. And I know that from my sister, who happens to be a school teacher, that of course there's apprehension on all sides, you know, from the parents, from the staff involved. But I also know that there are very strict measures in place. And I believe that, I don't think it's going to be as excruciating as people believe, because everyone has had to receive such rigorous training just to fall in line with government guidelines. And yes, now, before it happens, it seems unachievable. But I think you'll be surprised just how achievable it will be based on the new rules that are coming into place. Anyway, I'm perfectly sure we will find out much more about this, as I say, when we speak to Rabbi David Meyer later on in this podcast. Let's cram in one more story. Page 32 of the Jewish News this week. Desert Island Books is the headline I read here. It looks like it's a podcast. What's that about? You're promoting other podcasts. Unbelievable.
Oh, it's embarrassing that you should find out live on air that we're going behind your back. It's Zaki Cooper, who's a broadcaster.
And a superb chap as well, I might add.
Indeed. So the latest in our series of Desert Island Books is an interview with none other than Simon Sharma, the great historian, about the books that have inspired him. So I thought we could have a chat, the three of us, about the books that have inspired us. Sir Simon Sharma, he's mentioned books like A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, War and Peace by Tolstoy, etc. I am starting to read my old favourite books when I was a kid with my four-year-old at the moment, Danny Champion of the World, House at Pooh Corner. So that's really where I am in terms of literature at the moment.
And that's not necessarily anything to do with your children's age. Whether they were here or not, you would still be reading those books. Is that right?
I would. And I use my finger on every line just to... What are you reading? What did you last read, Phil?
Oh, interesting. Well, at the moment, I have just started a book called The Gatekeeper, which is by broadcaster Russ Kane. And it's his first attempt at literature. And I have to tell you, so far, I am hooked. But I'd say that in terms of sort of books that stick in my mind, there are a couple. But to name, I think, one of them in particular was one called The Gratitude Cradle, which was by a lady by the name of Rona Beck, who has sadly died. I think I was the last person to interview her. But the book, she's taken from a story of Holocaust survival, so a chap who survives the Holocaust and who is trying to tell his grandchildren, who are technically not Jewish because his children have married out, to try and let them know about their Jewish heritage before his life comes to an end. And there's fascinating references to and from the Old Testament, or the Torah as we obviously know it, and comparing it to the life that he's led. And it, I think it's a really cleverly written book, and just one that stuck in my mind. And she also takes some inspiration from her ancestry coming from South Africa. So that's certainly one that sticks in my mind. But others, of course, are ones that sort of have some of the famous quotes in it. You know, for example, from Orwell, all animals are equal, some are more equal than others. Of course, that's from Animal Farm. So I think that literature plays a massive part in all of our lives throughout, really. Bridget, I don't know, what about you?
I haven't got the energy to hold a book at the moment, or a Kindle. I downloaded on the Woody Allen autobiography, Apropos of Nothing. And I have got to tell you that, I mean, I'm his biggest fan. I adore him. He can do no wrong in my eyes. And I have to tell you that this book and him reading it is quite extraordinary. He talks about things I never, ever knew about his life. He talks about his bar mitzvah. He's written about all of this in this amazing autobiography, which you can download and listen to him read on Amazon for 99p. And that's as good as it gets until I fall asleep.
Well, it's certainly good enough for me, I'd say. So anyway, sadly, that's all we've got time for a look at the paper for this week. But thank you both very much indeed. Don't forget that if you would like to collect your copy of the Jewish News, you can do every Thursday. Or if you are stuck indoors at the moment, then the full paper can be viewed on the website, which is jewishnews.co.uk. Thank you both.
Thanks, Bill.
This is the JN Podcast in association with Jamie, the mental health charity for the community. Now, this week, various names from the world of entertainment have shown their support for the Sue Harris Trust. The charity's Save a Life Party, held with JLGB in a media partnership with Jewish News, sought to encourage members of the community to request a swab kit and register as a potential stem cell donor. Well, let's speak to one of those big names who helped highlight the occasion. I'm delighted to say we can now speak to TV's Judge Rinder, or Robert Rinder, as I hope he doesn't mind being known. Thank you very much indeed for speaking to us on the JM Podcast. First and foremost, I think we should start off with perhaps if you tell us what your involvement was with the Sue Harris Trust events. What did you have to do and how did it work?
So like quite a few people, I actually wasn't necessarily terribly aware about the particular problem that faces the Jewish community in the too few number of donors available to give bone marrow. And I was doing another event and then somebody emailed and I started reading the work of the Sue Harris Trust. And what's so beautiful about it, it seems to be, well, it was set up by people who knew her, this extraordinary campaigner whose life was lost because she was unable to find a match. And from the early days of her disease, was told that there was a particular problem within the Jewish community, that there was far too few people registered, which struck me as slightly odd, really, because of the Jewish emphasis, our community's emphasis on the importance of life being the kind of fundamental epicenter of everything we do biblically. And of course, the other impulse, which is simcha, joy and delight. So the way of highlighting so much more that needs to be done for this, it's a charity, but it's also, of course, a movement to ensure that there are a lot more people who are on the database who could be potential matches. The best way to celebrate that was through the medium of a party.
And I worry that sometimes what happens with situations like this, especially with certain conditions, is that the Jewish community sometimes, and this is not everyone, obviously, but sometimes they can have this horrible misconception of immunity. It's as if somehow we don't have certain conditions affect us. And it really does take events like this to remind us that we're all susceptible to all sorts of things.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I think it's one of those things, unless it happens and until it happens to a member of your family, it's not something that necessarily is at the top of the apex of things that one's interested in until you become aware of just how important and, of course, how prolific it is. There's something I think intuitively frightening about the idea of giving bone marrow. And that partially is because of the way in which it used to be donated in the past, that it felt like an invasive procedure. But of course, in the journey of the life of this disease, now the way in which the bone marrow is transplanted is infinitely less arduous and invasive as well. So there's a sense in which I think perhaps there's another part of it, which is there's also a Jewish impulse to give tzedakah, to give charity, but once you say you're going to do it, you have to follow through. And I think perhaps there's a reticence, or there certainly was, because why make a promise like that? And in the event you find yourself as a match, not just feeling obliged, but really you sort of bound into doing something which might be dangerous and frightening. And the reality is that's just not the case anymore. I couldn't be, you know, I'm emphasizing that on purpose because it isn't. You know, the procedures really have changed and improved massively over the years. You know, you used to have to give blood. Now it's just a cheek swab.
Now, it is a rather star-studded event that took place this week. It may have been over Zoom, but all the same, I understand that comedian Simon Brodkin was involved, as was former Love Island contestant Al Brooker. And I just wondered if you could maybe, for those who might have missed it, tell us exactly how the evening unfolded and what happened.
Well, yeah, first of all, I have to give, I think the right expression is a shout out to JLGB and Neil Martin, and just a brilliant organisation. You know, there are so many amazing examples, and I use that word, you know, very often when we as a community collectively experience anti-Semitism, you realise you're never realistically going to be able to argue with somebody that holds those kind of malignant views. And so I've always espoused, when I'm teaching advocacy, the best way of responding is by pointing people in the way of really good examples of who we are as a community at our best. And I really do think JLGB are just a really amazing example of that. So they kind of organized all the technology, and there were some videos, including from Sue Harris's friends and people who ran the charity, and also some stand-up comedy. It's quite an interesting thing because the comedians really sort of rely on their audience. And it was really fascinating to watch as they were doing their sets to, well, an empty room, just in one case, in their actual bedroom. It was quite fascinating, and it did get a bit blue before the watershed, but apart from that, it was very funny indeed. Some great jokes.
Now, I have to tell you that you're obviously, I'm guessing that due to COVID, the filming of the TV show has come to a pause for a moment.
Mm-hmm. But that's right. Yeah.
When you do film the show, I have to ask you, because I've been itching to ask this. I'm sorry.
Sure,
this has nothing to do with the event. I'm just going to put it out there.
You are,
in all seriousness, a very clever and widely respected lawyer who does great work, not just in the community, but way beyond that. Mm. And yet, there are some folk who appear on your TV show, Judge Rinder, for those who haven't got a clue what I'm talking about, though I doubt it, and they appear to have the most trivial of problems. Do you ever get annoyed with them for wasting your time?
Well, that's the thing, but I mean, and I understand why you'd ask that question, but I think that only represents a tiny number of the cases that we bring. And I understand why people, you know, focus on that. It's usually the question I'm asked. But avid watchers or people even who watch the show really perhaps only remember the more pantomime of cases. Of course, you know, when you watch a case, for example, about a goat that's eaten the contents of a woman's handbag at a city farm, and she's suing for, well, she's suing the owner of the city farm for the contents of her handbag. You know, I understand why people think that that's a bit trivial. Or the odd case that I don't know, about a randy shih tzu that sexually violated a cat. Again, I can understand objectively why that might seem trivial, but three things really. Firstly, it really often, no matter how small the issue is, isn't trivial to the people who've brought the cases and litigants. They genuinely mean it. And secondly, even cases that seem on the face of it to be quite trivial, often at their core have some of the most complex and nuanced legal issues to be determined. You know, the most important legal principle, or legal case, I should say, the common law, I'd say the most important, I think most lawyers would agree, is a case called Donoghue and Stevenson. And that really was the critical case which established what obligation I owe to a neighbour. And by that, I mean the extent to which I'm bound to look after them in some way, what tortious liability is. So what my duty of care is to another person as a manufacturer, as a neighbor, etc., as somebody that owns a business, especially. That case was all about two women who were having lunch, and one found a snail in her ginger beer bottle. And truly, you know, go Wikipedia it if you're listening to this, called Donoghue and Stevenson, really important case. And sometimes, even when my cases have that thin veneer of pantomime, at the core will be a really fascinating and challenging legal issue. Often the type of thing you'd set a pretty bright group of law students, you know, in their first or second year dealing with contract or tort. And the third thing is that, sure, I deal with those sorts of cases from time to time, of course, from time to time. And as anyone that watches it know, I'll tell them if they're wasting my time. But a significant portion, if not the vast majority of the cases, aren't that. You know, they're cases involving families that have broken down through really toxic conflict. Often it's about other things, but the court's an opportunity for them to hear one another, to be gifted the chance to be conscripted into a place where they physically have to listen. And the second thing is we deal with landlord and tenant, for example. Again, those are by no stretch of the imagination trivial cases. Or, for example, cases where somebody spent perhaps their life savings doing up a part of their house and they've instructed a builder who's fallen short. At the core are real legal principles, and despite how trivial they may seem to others, at some point, you watch my show in a week and at least half, if not all of them, will be experiences you've personally had or ones that you know of.
Well, what can I say? I think I, along with many others now, have hopefully seen your show in a whole new light. So thank you very much indeed for that.
Oh,
and thank you very much indeed for speaking to us on this week's edition of the JM Podcast. Judge Robert Rinder, thank you.
Pleasure. And well done, Jewish News. Keep on reading. I'm a big Jewish News fan. So keep going. Lots of luck.
This is the JN Podcast in association with Jamie, the mental health charity for the community. Now, every week here on the JN Podcast, we like to meet a COVID hero. This is someone from the community who has been doing extraordinary work during the pandemic. Now, I have to say that in this edition, our hero is someone who I've had the pleasure of working with and getting to know over the last few years through maybe other walks of Jewish radio life. Raymond Simonson is the CEO of JW3. And now JW3 obviously is sadly closed to the public, but that does not mean that the great work that they do and then some has stopped. Quite the opposite, in fact, as the centre has pretty much turned into a community hub like no other. I'm delighted to say that Raymond joins me now to explain all. Raymond, as ever, a pleasure to speak to you, sir, but perhaps you could start off by telling us what has become of JW3 during these lockdown times.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on, Phil, and it's good to hear that you sound in good health, so that's always great news.
It hasn't kicked me down yet, thank God.
Can't keep a good man down. Look, I think the first thing I'll say is genuinely, it's humbling and mildly embarrassing to be introduced as a COVID hero of the week. And what I will hopefully explain is that although you're speaking to me, I am really just the representative of the organisation, and mostly there are other people, one of whom in particular I'm going to name and embarrass as being the real hero of this particular social action work we're doing during this response, and his name is Jacob Foreman, and I'm going to talk a little bit about him in a minute. But I'll tell you first what we've been doing since we closed down. We closed the doors of the building, but exactly as you said, we haven't closed the doors of JW3. And I think if one thing the community has really understood more than ever before is that JW3 is absolutely not just a building. The building is the physical place people come to, but our vision and mission as a charity is so much more than that. And so we switched into a kind of a three-plank strategy from the minute we closed our doors. The first one is to become a virtual Jewish community center. So all of those wonderful adult education courses and classes and the Hebrew language and arts and culture, family activities, all of those kind of things, as much as we could move online as possible, we could. We opened JW3 TV on our website. We put on loads of phenomenal archive content, and we've been creating new content. In fact, just
this week,
which
may I say is fabulous, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yes, you may certainly say that, Phil.
Thank you.
The second thing we did was we focused on the fact that we are a hub, a cross-communal hub for the whole community. And even though we can't bring in all the different partner organizations into our building, we launched Jewish Online. And that's a great portal, whether you want to go and daven in an Orthodox synagogue or join the Reform Youth Movement or whatever it is you want to do, you can find the best of British Jewish online life through that website. And then the third thing, and I suspect this is the thing you probably have invited me on to talk about mostly, is our social action, our Tikkun Olam agenda. And that's been the thing that has just grown I mean, exponentially in the last few weeks.
Well, of course, Tikkun Olam, to those who don't know, I'm sure they do, but just in case someone listening doesn't know, of course, is about repairing the world and making the world a better place. That's the Jewish ethos. Now, you certainly are doing that because JW3 has become a food hub. Is that right? Is that the best way of describing it?
Yeah, absolutely. We've been doing a few things. One of the things we've been doing, again, this fantastic colleague of mine, Jacob Foreman, who is our social action and volunteering programmer. We started the minute we went into lockdown by setting up a befriending scheme. So there's about 100 people, the people that we know maybe are regulars at JW3, maybe lonely or vulnerable. They get a weekly phone call from one of our volunteers or a staff member to check in on them. Very quickly, we grew and said, what's the next thing we can do? And we looked at... this was really important. We wanted to make sure we did no harm, something we learned a lot from Sir Trevor Pears, who says it a lot with their philanthropy. Do no harm. Don't make a mistake of thinking you're doing something good, but it just satisfies your need to do good. So we didn't jump into it. We started speaking to partner organisations around the Camden Borough and around West Hampstead and Hampstead to see what their needs were and where we have the resources and the ability to help them. And we quickly saw that food was an important critical need. So we partner with a small voluntary organisation called Feast, F-E-A-S-T. They collect unused food that is maybe going to be thrown away but is still in good condition, and volunteers cook that food for vulnerable people. So we have, ever since the day we closed the doors to the building, we started with once a week a cookery session, and 50 hot nutritious meals go to local vulnerable people not far from JW3. That has now grown. We're now doing that a couple of times a week, and there's about 150 people every week get a hot meal, about 50 of whom are Jamie service users. You mentioned this is in partnership with Jamie, this podcast. I'm delighted that our volunteers now make food once a week and Jamie volunteers come and pick it up and distribute it to about 50 service users of theirs. Then it grew even further. We said, what about the people that actually need food parcels? And what happened was, I was inspired by the fact that, if you remember a few weeks ago, it was the Yellow Candles campaign for Yom HaShoah, where, you know, people were taking yellow candles and lighting them.
Indeed.
So when we closed our building, we had about 600 or 700 of these candles left. And I took them home and I put them in my front yard, might be overstating it, in the front of my house, and I through social media,
your
and
salary
through
is
my
too
WhatsApp,
high Raymond salary too high yeah.
In my, around, just over my moat, yeah. In my little in my house in Finchley, we've got a very small patch of concrete outside the front of our house. I put about 600-700 of these yellow candles over the space of a week. Every single one of them was taken by someone who then lit it on Yom HaShoah. And that was just through the power and the networks of social media. And I thought, well, if I can get people to come to my house to pick up a candle, we can certainly get people to come and drop off a can of food. And that's what we started doing. We started saying, if you can, like me, put a couple of boxes outside your house and message all your friends and neighbors to come and bring food to you, and then once a week, if you can collect, fill up your boot and bring that food to JW3, then we can start doing good. And we started doing that and really providing meals for a couple of hundred people. And within a week or so, Camden Council, who we'd been liaising with, said, look, we can bring it's a one-off 1.5 tons of food that's surplus from our food banks. Could you distribute it? And suddenly we found ourselves distributing 3,500 meals worth of food on that first week.
And also, may I just say, there's a very striking image that's out there in the world of social media of an HGV that's backed into the forecourt of JW3 that's delivering all of that food. So it gives you a real idea of how much food you guys have been dealing with. Now, Raymond, typically of you and I speaking on radio, we've sort of run out of time, but I do want to throw in a couple more points really quickly. The first one being, as you mentioned, the marvellous work that Feast do. I just want to reassure people and anyone who might have misunderstood what was said, because that you said about food that could be about to be thrown out but was still within date. The way that Feast work is they work with organisations, because I have had dealings with them. They work with organisations. There are quite strict rules and regulations in place with mainstream food providers such as restaurants and supermarkets and things like that, that they have to get rid of food that don't meet certain criteria, that but they are perfectly in date, they're perfectly usable. I don't want people thinking they're getting leftovers or gone off food. And then the other thing as well I want to throw in as well was that it's important to stress that this is by no stretch of the imagination just for the Jewish community. The fact you're working with Camden Council, this is for the benefit of a community at large.
I'll say just two very quick points then. One is, you're absolutely right. It's sell by dates are not the same as use by dates. so that it's all 100% safe. And the second point is, you mentioned that articulated lorry. This is the final, well, I say final, who knows what will grow next. But as of about a week ago, we upscaled even further, and we now take delivery of about 4.5 tons of food, which comes via the Arsenal Foundation. And as a lifelong Spurs fan, that doesn't roll off the tongue so easily for me. But really, really well done to Arsenal and Camden Council, because we are now, Camden have now been able, because of JW3, been able to open a second main hub, distribution hub, which means that all this food we have, we've cleared out our restaurant space. We've got about 10 pallets, 4.5 tons, 15,000 meals worth of food, which now goes out via Camden Council's network to a whole series of other food banks. So we have our own food bank, and we are now the central hub supplying for the whole of the north of the borough of Camden. And all of that is coordinated by this fantastic colleague of mine, Jacob, with a growing army of volunteers that are doing this work. So I really doff my cap to them.
And we doff our cap to you, sir. Raymond Simonson, CEO of JW3, you are our COVID hero for this week. Thank you, not just for speaking to me, but for the amazing work you are doing during these very strange times. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me.
This is the JN Podcast in association with Jamie, the mental health charity for the community. Now, there's much anticipation across all communities at the news that certain school years are to go back from Monday, the 1st of June. Our community obviously has its own concerns surrounding the return to education, but how are our Jewish schools preparing for the next step in the battle against COVID-19? Let's speak to Rabbi David Meyer, who's the Executive Director for PAGES, the Partnership for Jewish Schools. Rabbi Meyer, first and foremost, let's start off with that very question. What are our Jewish schools doing to prepare for the return to education?
Well, it's fair to say that the head teachers and members of staff in the schools have been really busy preparing for this return. And I think there are a number of levels. Was talking about it, particularly from a health perspective, I think that there are two different aspects with regards to this approach, which are both critical to understand. The first one is ensuring that the people who are coming into school are those, if you want, who are not high risk, whether that is the students or whether the children are coming from homes which are households where there is anybody high risk, or indeed ensuring that there are not severely vulnerable members of staff coming into the school. That immediately is reducing the risk and finding the right balance in the school. At the same time, obviously, any child who is unwell is also not allowed to return to school. But from the actual perspective of the school, what schools are doing now is planning to break the classes up into smaller groups, creating, if you want, clusters or these social bubbles within the school. So you'll probably have about 12 to 15 students in each group. They will have a dedicated teacher working with them. They will have social distanced tables and chairs in the classrooms. They will also have special provision arranged for them with regards to any break time or food in the cafeteria, etc. All of those provisions are being put in place in order to ensure the best possible health structures and protection for the children and the teachers within the schools.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the teachers, because obviously the news would have us believe that children are less at risk when it comes to coronavirus, or COVID-19 to be more precise. And that's precisely why it was felt that certain school years could go back to school without any major threat to their health. Of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that the same can be said for the staff. So what sort of support network is in place for the staff? And have you had to try and, for want of a better term, pacify some of the staff before they return to their positions at the schools?
I think it's important to recognise that everybody is nervous and fearful. And the reality is that we don't know enough about COVID-19 in order to be able to give fully informed and fact-based decisions. There are suggestions at the moment that children not only are less susceptible to the virus, but are very unlikely to pass that virus on. If that is the case, that would obviously be very welcomed. We just don't know how accurate that is, and indeed what age group that stretches across. So it is important that sensible precautions are taken by the teachers. As I mentioned, it is first and foremost that severely vulnerable teachers would not be coming into the school. But even for any member of staff, I think taking sensible precautions are important, and that really includes ensuring that you're staying 2 metres away from every student. But those 2 metres, it's important to understand, is 2 metres for 15 minutes. So if a child comes along, and it's likely to happen in the first day, kid wants to come, give a hug to the teacher or walk up to a teacher and get close proximity to them, it is not the end of the world. The teacher needs to ensure that they separate themselves quickly. It's a very short interaction, ensuring that the children and the teacher wash their hands carefully.
Which is all well and good, of course, but I think that something that is going to trouble some people to quite a great degree is how you get that message through, especially to younger children, that they have to try and maintain that 2 meter distance, especially. And don't get me wrong, I'm not suspecting that you have the answer to this, Rabbi Meyer. I think I'm expressing quite a lot of concern for a lot of people, is that even though it's a 15 minute window, which I have to admit I didn't know, which is really good to hear. It's nice to know that it's not a case of instantly you come into contact with someone and then you're in risk, there are a potential risk there. But I don't know how you go about implementing to someone who's too young to really understand exactly how they have to keep 2 meters apart. I suspect that's probably where some people are going to struggle a little bit with it.
Yes, and I think let's understand that the longer that people are within that 2 meter gap, the more dangerous it is. So therefore, the ideal is that people will stay apart as much as possible. I think the answer here is actually education. And the irony of it is that schools are really good about education and know exactly how to inform children. So it's about setting expectations and standards. And I suspect that the children actually will adapt quite quickly. They're more resilient than we think, and they're going to pick up quite quickly. Thankfully, I don't think we're going to be looking in classrooms which have got children wearing masks and distancing sticks from their arms, as I think we have seen in some countries in Asia. But I think that if the message is given in a sensible way, and also that no fear is contained within that, I think that we need to be able to have these rules but not blow them out of proportion in order to be able to ensure, which is a really important part, that the well-being and mental health of the children are also protected.
And one thing, of course, we've got to think of as well is that as slowly but surely the country comes to term with the easing of the lockdown, it means that people are going to have to return to work. Subsequently, it means that parents are going to have to let their children go back to school, as otherwise there will be no childcare option for them. Just finally, what advice have you got for parents of children who are heading back to school who may be a bit apprehensive, and understandably so?
Well, I think the most important thing to understand is that it's all about balance, and you cannot lock your children up forever. The reality is that, unfortunately, this virus is going to probably be with us for quite a while. And so, therefore, it is about taking sensible precautions. I think asserting with your children the importance of taking sensible action and keeping their hands clean and washing their hands regularly and keeping a distance from their friends and from the teacher is really important. But I think at the same time, you've really got to encourage them and enthuse them so that they are excited about returning to school, to seeing their friends, to going back to learning, which actually is really important for them. I think we need to understand that as dangerous as the virus is, there is also a significant danger with regards to children being locked up for extended periods, as with regards to adults. And it's also about working about the well-being and motivation of children.
And I assume if anyone wants more information, they either go to the Pages website or get in contact with the school that their child goes to.
Exactly. And there is a special section on our website with regards to returning to school, which includes some webinars from real experts on this topic, both from a health perspective and a well-being perspective. And I would encourage parents to visit and take a look.
And of course, your website is pages.org.uk. And for those who don't know, Pages is spelt P-A-J-E-S, pages.org.uk. Rabbi David Meyer, Executive Director of Pages, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us on this edition of the JN Podcast.
No problem. Thank you very much, and Chag Sameach to everyone.
This is the JN Podcast in association with Jamie, the mental health charity for the community. Now, utensils, tools, and scraps of leather were found in a prisoner's block at Auschwitz during renovation and restoration work. The items were discovered last month and have been handed over to the Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum for conservation. We can now speak to Pavel Savishki, who is of the memorial and museum at Auschwitz-Birkenau, to find out more. Pavel, this sounds like a very intriguing discovery and begs the question how on earth this wasn't discovered sooner.
We need to remember that the site of the memorial is huge. We talk about two historical sites, Auschwitz I and Auschwitz II-Birkenau. We are talking about a site with 150 buildings, ruins. So there are plenty of places. And we need to remember that, of course, many objects have been found so far. The memorial exists for over 70 years, and our collections is enormous. We have tens of thousands of objects, or even hundreds of thousands, because a little bit over 100,000 shoes, thousands of suitcases, and many other items. We also have some remains of the Canada storage area. Canada was a place where the SS stored, sorted, disinfected, and prepared to be sent out all the property that Jews deported for extermination brought with them, and then prisoners had to sort everything. And the storage area was set on fire by the SS when the camp was getting to be evacuated. And we also have tons of melted metal items that we are now trying to make into separate items. And this is a tremendous work. And of course, prisoners try to smuggle things from the Canada storage area, hide them because they wanted to use them for their own purposes. And it is, of course, clear that they were not able to have those items on them. It was risky. They could be found by the SS or by the functionaries. Therefore, they tried to find hiding places.
Let's look at what these items were. I've mentioned them sort of briefly, but can you go into a bit more detail as to what was discovered?
So right now at the Auschwitz I site, there is a new exhibition being made by the Austrians. There will be a new Austrian National Pavilion in block number 17. And this kind of works involve the building, because the building needs to be restructured for the exhibition purposes. And of course, the authentic building is preserved and our conservators supervise the entire process. However, such works can go deeper into the structure of the buildings. And in one of the flues, what was discovered was around 200 objects, mainly everyday objects like cutlery, spoons, forks, some knives, pieces of leather, nails, fragments of metal. So these are objects that were recently discovered, and they were already handed over to our conservation lab, and they will be added to our collections.
And what would you say that items such as pieces of leather would have been used for? Do we know? Because that seems like quite an odd thing to stash away.
So, of course, it's very difficult to say whether some of the objects were hidden there purposely. It was a flue, so also it is possible that some other objects were simply thrown inside there as trash. So, of course, after 70 years, we are not able to be very precise here. Maybe some of the items were covered with some pieces of leather or paper, and then when it was used or burned, they could be burned. So here we can only interpret. What is important is that in some of the media articles about this discovery, there were some speculations that maybe it was kind of a hiding place related to resistance movement, or maybe some kind of preparation for escape. We find these completely unfounded. We simply know, thanks to other discoveries like this and also testimonies of survivors, that, as I said at the very beginning, prisoners try to find some location where they will be able to find objects which were useful to them, which were illegal according to the SS authorities, and they would not be seen. So we simply think that we discovered a very similar hiding place to others that we found in the past in block number 14, also in a flue, or in block number 27 at the roof area, so roof construction elements. We found some others under the floor. So such hiding place existed, and during conservation work, where we can analyze the building thoroughly, we still can have such discoveries.
Now, there will be some people listening, myself included, who thinks of somewhere like Auschwitz-Birkenau as being so historic that therefore it shouldn't be touched. You know, there shouldn't be building work going on there. But of course, it must be essential in the sense that otherwise, if there is no restoration work that happens, there is a chance that the buildings that we know have to stay there for historic purposes might fall into such a state that they might be unsafe to visit, or indeed never be seen again because they could disintegrate.
So, of course, when we talk about a site like the Auschwitz Memorial, we are not exactly talking about restoration. We prefer the word conservation, because our philosophy is not to change any authenticity that remained after the war. And this is crucial for us right now, to preserve any authentic remains. And buildings, of course, are very important, but we also preserve ruins in its condition. So our work aims to save any authentic remains that survived and that people can see at the site, whether it's a building or pieces of cutlery similar to what was found. And therefore, we have very strict regulations and very strict philosophy of, you know, doing only the most essential works and only link with the preservation. It's not rebuilding, it's not restoring, it's preserving any authentic element. And during such works, such discoveries are made. And right now, the most important conservation works are in Birkenau, at the site of Auschwitz-Birkenau. The brick barracks that are there, where prisoners slept, 45 brick structures exist in Birkenau, standing, and 30 of them were living barracks. And these buildings are in very difficult conservation condition. If we do nothing, they would simply fall. They would fall apart, and we cannot lose this authenticity. And therefore, a large-scale conservation works inside those brick barracks, which are basically holistic. I mean, the conservation team works with everything, starting from the foundations and even creation of new foundations supporting the very weak original ones up to the top of the roofs. And during these conservation works, we found thousands of items because some earth must be removed in order to be able to build the new foundations. This earth is, of course, researched archaeologically because we have to make sure that, you know, nothing is missed, and therefore pieces of cutlery, some pieces of jewelry, coins, buttons, some things that prisoners made in the camp, they are discovered because only such works allow us to in a way go so deeply with our research. It is important to emphasize that we have also very strict rules. There are some ideas that maybe we should research the whole site archaeologically, but there is a very strict regulations and recommendations also made by the International Auschwitz Council that archaeological research is carried out exclusively for the purpose of conservation works and also securing the museum objects. So it is only accompanying the works that we need to do to preserve the authentic site. It's not just archaeology in order to search. It is something that we find unethical, and this is already beyond our philosophy of conservation.
Well, thank goodness there are people like you who are working so tirelessly to conserve such history. Pavel Savitsky, thank you so much for speaking to me on the JN podcast about this really fascinating discovery.
Thank you very much for this invitation.
Well, as promised, we now have a nice shiny new feature involving comedian Ashley Blaker. He is going to be delivering us a message that will hopefully shed a bit of humour on the situations we find ourselves in.
Hello, Ashley. No, stand back. Stand back. You're listening to this far too close to me. Just move back a bit. Thank you. Look, I'm not saying you've got it, but we shouldn't take risks, should we? Come on, social distancing. Let's keep our 2 metres. I'll start again. Hello, Ashley Blaker here. And very nice to be speaking to all the listeners of the Jewish News podcast. And what a time it is. What a bizarre period to be alive. Do you remember those halcyon days when you could go out to a restaurant and meet someone in the street and shake their hand? If they were another man, I would shake their hand, obviously. If it was a woman, I wouldn't. Let's just clarify that straight away. I've been avoiding handshakes for years. It's only now everyone else has jumped on the bandwagon. But it has been a bizarre period, probably the most bizarre period of all of our lives, and incredibly hard for a hypochondriac like me. I know we're all meant to Google the symptoms, but I'm a man who once self-diagnosed Dutch elm disease, so this really isn't good for me. But it has felt like 6 months. It was only back in March, it really wasn't that long ago, that the whole world started wearing masks, and it wasn't anything to do with Purim. People were suddenly scared to go out. I actually used this opportunity to send an email to 2,000 friends telling them that I had bought them Mishloach Manos, but unfortunately I was self-isolating, so I couldn't deliver them. In truth, actually, I am going to self-isolate for 2 weeks at some point. I'm just waiting until just before Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Let's not waste those 2 weeks indoors when the shuls aren't even open. But everything suddenly started to close down very quickly after Purim. Schools are closed, shuls obviously closed. Now, we live in the heart of Edgware, across the road from both a school and a shul. And I had genuinely forgotten what it was like not to have our driveway blocked 24/7. And then, for some bizarre reason, and I still not really got to grips with the reason why, the entire world started panic buying toilet paper. Now, this is really quite a strange thing. If someone broke into your shul now, they would leave the Sifrei Torah and all the money collected in the tzedakah boxes, and they'd just head straight for the restrooms. And this is life-changing. I don't think we can really ever take toilet paper for granted now. When all this is over, we get a lot of collectors coming to our door. The next time a charity collector knocks on my door, I'm just going to give them a few sheets, maybe a quarter of a roll if I'm feeling particularly flush. No pun intended. But it does actually seem to me that everyone wants to be Jewish. Think about it. The world started wearing masks just before Purim, started panic buying just before Pesach, and then everyone started counting days and weeks in quarantine and not taking haircuts just before the Omer. You know, I wouldn't be surprised at all if a doctor claimed that the virus can be cured by eating cheesecake. But I think the moment I personally realised how grave a situation this was when I read in the newspaper, genuinely, I read this in the newspaper, I am not making this up, that ISIS told their followers not to travel to Europe because of coronavirus. Now, that is one serious illness, when even suicide bombers and terrorists, whose sole purpose is to kill people, as many people as possible, often including themselves, are a little bit scared of it. That does seem rather scary. Those 72 virgins can wait. By the way, some of you will know that I did a UK tour last year with a Muslim comedian called Imran Yusuf. And we spent many hours together in the car, usually with Imran driving, because as a Muslim, he couldn't ever claim he'd been drinking. But I actually did ask him about the 72 virgins, and he says it's made up, not even true. So, which does actually make sense to me, because it does seem rather an arbitrary number. Die a martyr and you'll be rewarded with 72 women who have never had sex. Because 71 wouldn't be enough, but 72 would just be one too many. As long, of course, as it isn't one 72-year-old virgin. That would actually be rather a big deterrent. Quite a good idea. They should come up with that. Interesting, actually, what questions, when you get a Muslim and a Jew together in a car, it's interesting what questions they ask each other. Because I just wanted to ask Imran about the 72 virgins. He just wanted to ask me about the hole in the sheet. So clearly, we've all got the same thing on the brain. And in case we have any non-Jewish listeners now, let me just clarify, that isn't true. That hole in the sheet thing, it isn't true. Although if you saw many of the men in my synagogue, you could imagine that their wives might want it to be true. Anyway, I've got to go and prepare for Yom Tov. Shavuos is not that long away, and I still haven't made my cheesecake. So I hope you're all keeping well. I will be back. Stay safe.
Comedian Ashley Blaker sharing his words of humour and wisdom there. Thank you very much indeed to him. And there you go. That's it for this episode of the JN Podcast in association with Jamie, the mental health charity for the community. At this stage, I would like to thank all of our guests, Robert Rinder, Raymond Simonson, Rabbi David Meyer, Pavel Savisky, and of course, our paper team, Richard Ferrer and Bridget Grant. And thank you for listening. We must also remember to thank Justin Cohen, who has produced this episode. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That way you'll hear any previous episode or be informed when new episodes become available. Don't forget that for more information on any of the stories we've featured, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. If you'd like to comment, then we'd love to hear from you on editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. From me, Phil Dave, do join us next time here on the JN Podcast. Goodbye.